Hello, and welcome to
Killing It
on Broadway. I'm Jennifer Simard.
And I am Jessica Vosk, and this is the podcast where we discuss all things guts, gore, murder, and mayhem.
It's not safe for work. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, Jennifer.
And hi, James Monroe Iglehart.
Hello, ladies. This is so cool.
I just have to say, we are so excited that you joined us today. Thank you so much for being here.
Please, it is my pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, thank you. You're so cool.
Girl, I try.
I love you so much. I have so many memories of sitting, little side note, sitting in the green room with you when we were doing Spelling Bee on Broadway. We would have our dinners together quite a bit.
Yes, we would.
And this is where I became, with all respect to Dawn, who your real wife, I became your show wife. We'd have our dinner and James would be casually reading a magazine. And if he wasn't paying enough attention to me, I'd let him know. And I'd finish my dinner and yell, pay attention to me. And he'd shut his magazine. Yes, ma'am. Yes, yes, yes.
Yes. Or you would hand your, I think my favorite is whenever you would finish, you would just hand your trash to me. And I was like, right. Well, you wouldn't even say anything. You would just go like, pick it up and just take it away.
That's right.
And James and I, this is Jessica now, don't have any of those memories together. But I wish that I did is what I'm trying to say. So this is why I'm extra just excited to be here and watch your love unfold.
Well, thank you very much. But you are a very talented lady. So I know of you and know your work. So I'm just so glad that we're actually on the same podcast.
I'm such a fan of yours.
Thank you, girl.
And James, speaking of talent, you, my friend, are so talented. You have this incredible, storied, successful, amazing career. Yet we're not here to talk about that today. We don't care.
No.
How do you feel about that? Are you all right with that?
You know, there are some days that don't have to be filled with just me in front in the spotlight. Some days it's me just, you know, in the back, being an audience member, you know, enjoying the story that's unfolding without me starring in it.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. Sometimes it's us just sitting in a closet, sitting in an egg crate container, living our dreams. And honestly, all Jen and I do now, and all of our listeners understand this at this point, we are true crime fanatics. We're obsessed with it. We understand a lot of our colleagues are too, which over the years, I don't know if you've ever felt this way, James, I have wondered, could I possibly be a serial killer? Am I so obsessed with this because I am a serial killer? Am I John Wayne Gacy? Am I a clown? But which also scares me at the same time. So James, when did you first realize you were interested in true crime, and why are you so into it, do you think?
I think it's because when you're doing a show and you're there from like 6:30 or, you know, 7:30 to 11 or 10 o'clock, and you get home and you go to your significant other or just kicking it with your, you know, by yourself, you get some food, you turn on TV, there's nothing on. Then you turn the channels and there it is, that channel where the people have the voices that say, she didn't know whether the person behind her was going to kill her or buy her a burger, but she found out fries don't go with that shake. And then you're stuck. You are just stuck watching the person get destroyed. And then the fact that I'll bring this up for one second. I want a Tony, and the Tony is beautiful. But that you realize that the Tony is actually a murder weapon. It is the exact shape of the things that everybody kills with. It's that nice thing on top. But that base is what a wife would use to kill her husband when she finds out he's cheating or something weird. And every time I look at it, I go, that's the weapon that somebody would kill somebody with. And my wife and I make jokes about that. So we watch the channel of people getting killed and getting killed in the stupidest ways or the greatest ways. It's like, you know, someone got killed by a Burger King shake or something, and you're just watching it. And then you watch other people, you know, say, yeah, well, we interviewed the person and he told us that he hadn't been to Burger King. But then we saw the camera and the guy's like, yeah, I guess I was. So I'm obsessed with the true crime. It doesn't matter whether it's 48 Hours or whether it's the ID channel, which they call Discovery, but my wife and I call it the Kill channel, where you just sit back and watch wives who snapped, wives who snapped twice, friends who snapped, husbands who snapped, husbands who've been snapped on, and you just spend your night sitting back together, talking about nothing and watching people die. And then you go to bed and you don't have any bad dreams. So that's how it started. I think it's, love it.
You have never seen two out-of-work actresses silently laughing more than Jessica Vosk and I during this story. that Tony Award winner James Murray Igelhart just relayed. Arms in the air, tears in our eyes.
Also,
am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong. And also, I just want to say to everybody right now, the feeling everybody has listening to him just say that is that we all want James to narrate our lives.
Yeah,
that's what we want. Because as soon am I wrong? No.
No.
You could tell me that you could say, Jessica, pick up that bottle of Pepto and use it to smack somebody in the head. But if James says it, I'll do it.
But yeah, the fun part is that's how people in those wonderful shows die. How those crime shows, that's those stories that you hear, those stories that seem completely unbelievable. And it's always that there's the people who narrate those stories are always so interested, but they put the emphasis in certain weird places. Mm-hmm. It's like if I said, Jessica was at home with her Pepto-Bismol, but it wasn't that she had acid reflux. She was using it to kill. And you're like, I have to watch this.
You've never like prepositions have never been the star of the show more than they are on these crime shows.
That's right. So true.
That's right.
I love those. And then, so then you end up, once you end up watching that, then you go down the rabbit hole of Netflix or, you know, Amazon of like, well, since I'm watching the amateurs do it, let's watch the real killer documentaries. And those are always the fun ones when they decide to like to interview the person that did it. And they go into the person's mind and you find out, you're like, so nobody knew you was crazy. Nobody saw it. You know, the fact that all of your puppies died. Nobody thought that maybe there might be an issue. You know, you killed your mom because you had bad grades. That's an issue. But I love them. So when you guys asked me to listen, I was like, I must do this.
Well, good. We're going to get started.
Go right ahead. I'm here.
James,
to listen. Go ahead.
As we launch into this, you are from Hayward, California, just outside of San Francisco. Mm-hmm. It's outside of San Francisco, yeah?
Yes.
And you were born in 1974.
Yes, ma'am.
Right. Okay. Now, we're going to get into this, but, you know, Jessica and I, one of the reasons we're excited is every now and then we like to do obscure cases that aren't really well known. And that's like the case you've chosen for us today, which is called the Zodiac Killer. Have you heard of it?
No one's heard of that.
Flummoxed.
No. All right. Now, you were not born at the time of this first case, which was in 1968. But since you're from that area, just to clear it up 100% for our listeners, James, are you the Zodiac?
No, I am not. But it just puzzles like that are just a little too difficult for me. So, no, I cannot claim that would be me.
Okay. He's clear, Jess.
Okay. He's cleared.
He's cleared. Thank you, James. You're no longer a suspect. Mm-hmm. You're no longer a suspect. Now, credit where credit is due. As we begin, we got a lot of our information from Wikipedia. Please donate to Wikipedia, everybody.
Yes.
As well as the terrific 2007 David Fincher film, Zodiac, which you just watched last week. Is that right, James?
I did just watch it. I just got through watching the film.
But when I sent you some choices for today, you said that this inspired you because you're from the area and B, you had just watched it and it seemed meant to be, correct?
Yeah, it just seemed meant to be. Also, when you're from the Bay Area, sometimes there are some jokes or things that are said that you don't get because they're just like I said, it was 1974 when I was born and stuff happened, of course, after that with the Zodiac Killer. But people would make jokes about the Zodiac Killer. And we as kids were like, yeah, Zodiac Killer. We didn't realize what a big thing it was. We didn't realize that the Bay Area was scared to death on lock that this person could come back at any time. And we as kids were just like, better be cool. It's the Zodiac Killer. Not realizing that our parents were like, don't say that shit. It can be real.
Well, honestly,
he was the Bay Area boogeyman.
Yeah, seriously, though.
Oh, yeah.
And as kids, you don't ever, it's not that serious. It's like, as kids, you're like, I'm going out and playing Manhunt. I remember.
Yeah, because you're not watching the news. You're not caring.
Right. And truly, there's so many complex layers to this case. This could be a year-long podcast. We could break this up over 8 episodes with you alone. But so today, we're going to cover some key points. So while the Zodiac may be responsible for up to 37 murders, we only have confirmation of 7 victims, 2 of which were survivors. So to begin with, we're going to discuss these crimes themselves.
Sounds great.
The first is the Lake Herman Road murders. On December 20th, 1968, high school students Betty Lou Jensen and David Faraday were planning their first date.
Oh.
They were Yeah, so sad. They were going to go to a Christmas concert, but instead they ended up visiting a friend, then getting a bite to eat, and then they went parking at a local Lover's Lane on Lake Herman Road. This was at about 10:15 at night. 45 minutes later, just after 11 p.m., their bodies were found by a woman who lived nearby. The killer, we're going to call him the Zodiac, shot David in the head, and as Betty Lou was running away, he shot her in the back 5 times. Her body was found 28 feet from the car.
That makes me sad because, look, we're in the middle of the Coco, and I haven't been able to date, you know? And I just, it makes me so sad to think that somebody was getting ready for their first date. How many times do we hear something like this? I'm getting ready for my first date, and, oh, I didn't realize I was going to get
murdered.
And their kids. Yeah, and their kids.
Yeah. Also, you know, that's just messed up. I mean, this is terrible. This is, because I'm such a man. And, you know, just you're just thinking, you're a young man. And the girl finally said, yes, she's sitting in the car with you. She's made the decision that she's not going to go all the way. But there's a couple bases you might get to. And right as you get to the base, somebody comes and just starts shooting. You're just like, you are afraid for your life. But there's part of you just going, come on. You couldn't have waited 20 minutes. Just kill me at 20 minutes.
This is why.
Jesus. But, you know.
This is why I'm so happy James is here today.
Yeah.
I know.
It was like every horror film. It's like right as somebody's about to like get some, they get killed.
No.
Or they wait till after. Like anybody who has sex in a horror film dies. Yep. So but these kids I felt really bad for because, you know, there was no answer or like there was no whim or reason. It just happened. Mm-hmm. And the Bay kind of were just like, whoa, people were murdered. What the hell? You know, the Bay Area was a very not quiet town, but nothing like that happened. You know, it wasn't like anything. So
yeah, they were by no fault of their own in the wrong place at the wrong time. He was on a mission and he was hunting and they happened to be there.
Well, which brings me to the next one, which is the Blue Rock Springs murder, which took place on the 4th of July in 1969 when Darlene Farron drove Michael McGow. Is that how we say it, Jen?
Majot.
Exactly correct.
Majot.
Darlene Farron drove Michael Majot to Blue Rock Springs Park in Vallejo, which was only 4 miles from the Lake Herman Road site where they too parked their car. And another car drove in and parked near them, but almost immediately drove away. And 10 minutes later, same car comes back. The driver, we're going to just call him the Zodiac, gets out, approaches the passenger side door where Michael was sitting, all of a sudden starts shooting. He fires 5 times. Both Michael and Darlene were hit with several bullets passing through Michael and into Darlene. So the Zodiac walks away, but comes back to shoot each victim 2 more times before driving away. Tragically, Darlene died from her wounds, but Michael survived despite being shot in the face, neck, and chest.
And this was the opening of the movie.
Yes.
Zodiac. Yeah.
And this was when the police, at least it seemed, were trying to connect the murders and the people. And the problem was the murders were connected, but the people were not.
Right.
And, you know, nowadays, you know, not 2020, everybody always, you know, oh, yeah, we can connect. You realize there is a connection to people. Or if there doesn't, it doesn't matter because we have DNA. But back then, they were just baffled at what was happening so close to each other.
Yeah. Well, next we have the Lake Berryessa murder. And if you've seen the movie, you'll know it's probably the hardest scene to watch in the movie, other than watching Robert Downey Jr. in that damn boathouse. Right? With the pong in the background and this and the alcohol and then he has an oxygen tank later. And you know that I read that didn't happen to that character. And he was brilliant in the movie. He's such a good actor.
Fantastic in the film.
He was so good.
Love him.
All right. Why don't you marry him if you love him so
much? Guess what? I will, because I'm hard up to have dates. Thank you.
All right. So on September 27th, 1969, college students Brian Hartnell and Cecilia Shepherd went for a picnic at Lake Berryessa. It's a beautiful day. They're hanging out on a blanket when a guy, the Zodiac, walks up to them wearing a costume, which was a black executioner-style hood with the eye holes cut out. And over the eye holes, he wore sunglasses. And just beneath the hood on his chest was the white cross circle symbol that we now know is the Zodiac symbol. Also, he brought pieces of clothesline and told Cecilia to tie up Brian. Once secure, the Zodiac tied up Cecilia himself. He then turned his attention back to Brian, where he noticed Cecilia hadn't really tied Brian's bonds terribly tightly. So he went ahead and he tightened them. Then he stabbed them. He stabbed Brian 6 times and Cecilia 10 times. A man and his son who were fishing nearby, helped them out. They got some help from some park rangers. Now, I never knew this next part until researching this, and it breaks my heart. But when police arrived at the crime scene, Cecilia was still alive. And this amazingly strong woman provided them with a detailed description of her attacker. Oh. She and Brian were then taken to the hospital in an ambulance. And while she was in the ambulance on the ride to the hospital, she lapsed into a coma and never regained consciousness again. She died 2 days later. And like the Blue Rock Springs murder, the male miraculously survived his wounds. And you guys, does it seem, I couldn't really find anything about this, but it does seem like the real targets were the targets of more anger were the women.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, when we decided to go with this one, I did a little reading, and it seemed like every time he went after the guys, he was vicious, but he was brutal when he went after the women. And there definitely was that kind of emotional connection to the ladies in his anger.
It's amazing to me the places that people will go, especially these murderers, and patterns that happen, I think, that are all psychologically induced, right? Especially these male killers who have had issues with their mother. And again, the psychology of it is something that I've always been obsessed with.
Listen, there's nothing, I think, crazier than going through life as a young woman with all the different things coming at you. But as a young boy, you are told one kind of line of life. Be a man. Mm-hmm. Be a man. And there's this wonderful fictional list of man stuff we're supposed to do to be men. And one of the things is we're not supposed to cry. We don't hug. We don't do these things. And if you don't let those emotions out, they come out in different ways when you become older. It's like that guy who gets broken up and he can't cry about it. So he goes and dates 50 girls, or he goes and stabs 50 girls. It's like there's this weird thing. If you don't teach a male to let his emotions out, they're going to come out a different way. And men are very physical. And people always go, men are not emotional. Yes, they are. And they don't know how to deal with powerful women because the men who have taught them don't know how to deal with powerful women. So you just have a generation after generation of dudes who have no idea how to deal with women. And then when these serial killers come out, you go, how come the woman was stabbed more? Well, go back to the boy's childhood. I bet you'll find a mom who was strict and a dude or father or non-father figure who didn't tell the boy how to deal with his emotions.
So spot on. That is so spot on. That's the stuff that I think to myself, oh my gosh, if they had the proper tools, patterns, they're very difficult to break unless you understand what the pattern is. You don't get the proper tools. And then it's a whirlwind, in my opinion.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm in my non-clinical opinion, those things. Yes.
No, James, one thing we do on this show is everyone we have on the show, they're now a doctor.
Oh, yeah.
So you're Dr. Eigelhart now. I think you've earned it. You've earned your degree today.
Try. You know, when I talk to people and help them out, I really try to make sure that they understand that, I'm here to help you. I'm not here to take anything away from you.
Oh, Dr. I really appreciate that. Which brings me to the last officially confirmed murder, which is the Presidio Heights murder. This took place October 11th, 1969, where a white male, let's just call him the Zodiac, got into a cab driven by a gentleman named Paul Stein at the intersection of Mason and Geary Streets near Union Square and asked to be taken to Presidio Heights. Side note, I love the Presidio. Paul drove one block past the desired stop when the Zodiac shot him once in the head, then took his wallet, car keys, and tore away a section of Paul's bloody shirt. This episode is brought to you by our best friends at Spindrift. Yes, you heard me, best friends. For those who know us, you know how addicted we are to true crime and sparkling water. Cue the day when we were both starring in Broadway shows and stumbled upon the Holy Grail, Spindrift.
America's first sparkling water with real squeezed fruit. Yep. That's it. 11 flavors with no worries about any chemicals going into your body. You'll have a crush on all flavors. Trust us.
Oh, and they make the perfect mixer for your holiday bevvies too. Ugh, the possibilities are endless. Just go now to drinkspindrift.com, find your match, and use our sassy sparkling code KILLIT20 at checkout and get 20% off your first order. Self-care, baby. After all, it's necessary in 2020.
Now, we're going to go back in time a little bit to the letters, the infamous letters and cryptograms and Sudoku shit. So on August 1st, 1969, three letters were received at the San Francisco Examiner, the Vallejo Times Herald, and the San Francisco Chronicle. The letters were almost exactly alike, and each also contained a third of a 400-symbol cryptogram, which the killer, we're going to call him the Zodiac, claimed contained his identity. The first letter read, and it's broken and grammatically incorrect here as I read it, quote, "I like killing people because it is so much fun. It is more fun than killing wild game in the forest because man is the most dangerous animal of all. To kill something gives me the most thrilling experience. It is even better than getting your rocks off with a girl. The best part of it is that when I die, I will be reborn in paradise, and then I have killed will become my slaves. I will not give you my name because you will try to slow down or atop my collecting of slaves for my afterlife." And it goes into gibberish. In the letter, he took credit for the shootings at Lake Herman Road and Blue Rock Springs and demanded that the newspapers print his cryptogram on the front pages, or else he would, quote, "cruise around all weekend killing lone people in the night, then move on to kill again until I end up with a dozen people over the weekend," unquote.
And on August 7th, 1969, another letter was received at the San Francisco Examiner with the salutation, "Dear Editor, this is the Zodiac speaking." This is the first time he actually used his name, and he wrote this letter because the chief of police asked for more details in order to prove that the writer had killed Betty Lou, David, and Darlene. He also wanted the police to know that when they cracked his code, quote, "they will have me." Now, on August 8th, 1969.
August 8th, that's my birthday.
Ah. Well, and a happy birthday to you, Jen.
Happy birthday to you, Jen.
Are you the Zodiac?
No.
Alrighty. So an ordinary couple, Donald and Betty Hardin, solved the 408 symbol cryptogram. You would think that they were in the midst of a quarantine to be able to do such a thing.
You would think.
Honestly, Betty,
yes.
Donald, welcome to the quarantine. It referenced, quote, "the most dangerous game." He also said he was collecting slaves for the afterlife. That's fun. There was no name in the decoded text, which is kind of a takesies-backsies situation. And
yes.
And the killer said that he would not give away his identity because it would slow down or stop his slave collection.
Okay.
Men and their slaves.
Honestly, if I had a nickel.
Don't get me wrong. I love my, what is it, genus, sex, whatever it is. I love my brothers, but, and when I say brothers, I mean all, you know, men, all men. We always want somebody to do stuff for us, you know, so.
Well, I wanted you to throw away my trash.
Yes, but there's a difference between a lady asking a man to throw her trash. A lady, we won't even get into the whole, you know, second job the lady had. Lady go gets up in the morning, takes care of the family, goes to a job, then comes home and goes to her second job. This brother is just killing people, hopefully, so he can have slaves so somebody else can do his work. What, now you too lazy to kill people? You want somebody else to kill while in the afterlife? Just this man shit constantly.
You heard it here from Dr. I. Man shit constantly. So, moving on October 14th, 1969, the Chronicle received another letter containing a bit of Paul Stein, the taxi driver, shirt as proof he was the killer. It also included a threat about killing school children on a school bus. The letter read, "just shoot out the front tire and then pick off the kiddies as they come bouncing out." Or can you imagine? On November 8th, 1969, the Zodiac mailed a card with another cryptogram consisting of 340 characters, and it's never been decoded. And guys, that's now officially all I want to do. Let's figure it out.
Just decode it. Yeah, just to sit back and decode it.
I think now's the time. Honestly, 2020 seems like the right time.
It's amazing that no one has decoded it yet. I don't know if it's... It makes me wonder... I've always wondered, is there more than one Zodiac?
Mm.
Was there, you know... Because there's nothing like... someone has an original idea... and then someone wants to be recognized. It really is about, you know, notice me, please. That someone else would do it. Because the others were made to be cracked. And what if this one is, you know, the person wasn't as good as the original Zodiac, so that's why it hasn't been cracked. Also, the I think one of my favorite moments of the film and then of the story, because I went back and, you know, read about it, was the fact that the Bay Area, you know, and just America in general. So the Zodiac's in the cab, and he kills the man, gets out of the cab. Kids across the street see it, and the kids tell the cops, "Oh my God, we saw somebody get killed." Well, who did it? The black dude.
No.
Okay. First of all, up in that area, ain't too many brothers, okay, in the Bay. Second of all, just because it was dark does not mean it was a black dude.
Wow.
So the cops, there's two cops who saw a man with a limp and kind of blood on him walk past them, and they didn't go after him because they were looking for a black guy.
Oh.
The guy literally walked past them, and they saw him looking disheveled. They saw him, you know, with stuff on him, and they didn't stop him because, you know, they're looking for a black guy, which is just, it was one of those moments where it was like, so just imagine being in quarantine in 2020, watching that particular scene and going, this man had blood on him. He was limping, and they knew there was a crime that had happened. But we're not going to work on this crime. We're going to look for the brother, because that's what they said.
Right.
Luckily, the times have changed. Everything's fine now.
Right. Everything's fine now. That would never happen.
They don't do
now.
That
never
now.
Happened
in,
today.
In 2020, no. I honestly could not even think of a case.
But that's the closest the police came to the Zodiac Killer. They were feet away from him.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least who they perceived to be the Zodiac Killer. And nobody stopped him because the word that came through was that they were looking for a black guy. And it's amazing how the detectives are like, yeah, but he didn't fit the color description, but he fit that. And when they went back to ask the kids said they didn't really get a good look. They saw the murder, but when, you know, there were shadows and the lights over there weren't working and stuff like that.
And Mark Ruffalo played the detective, and he, in that scene you reference, he was just like, you know, palm to head, like, you know, heads in palm, just like, you're kidding me. I'm so glad you brought that up. That was very important information. I too read that, and James, I'm so glad that you brought up this discussion. Thank you so much.
Well, and to keep going with our letters, December 20th, 1969, exactly 1 year after the murders of David Faraday and Betty Lou Jensen, the Zodiac mailed a letter to Belly. More on that in just a hot sec, but it contained another piece of Paul Stein's shirt. In the letter, the Zodiac said he wanted Belli to help him. Now, Belli refers to Melvin Belli, who was a big shot lawyer, brilliantly played by Brian Cox in the film. But back in October, the Zodiac, or someone claiming to be the Zodiac, called the Oakland Police Department demanding that either F. Lee Bailey or Melvin appear on the talk show AM San Francisco. And by the end of the televised phone conversation, Belli agreed to meet him at the Daily Center, but the so-called Zodiac never showed. Zodiac continued, though, to communicate through the press for the rest of 1970. And in October of that year, he sent a Halloween card to reporter Paul Avery, again, brilliantly portrayed by my boyfriend Robert Downey Jr. in the film, signed with a Z. The cross circle symbol, and written on it was, "Peekaboo, you're doomed." In what is believed to be the final confirmed letter of the Zodiac, dated January 24th, 1974, the Zodiac says, quote, "Me equals 37, SFPD equals zero."
Oof.
So I just got an idea just now that in every opening night card I give my friends, I'm going to write, "Peekaboo, you're doomed."
Which actually, it's right? Really kind of great, especially for Broadway.
It's kind of
like a great, it's like, you know, because to be honest, I mean, come on, break a leg is so old. It's so old. I mean, that is so, no disrespect, but that is so.
Yeah.
I think there are a lot of people who would have appreciated the warning, the foreshadowing last winter,
you.
Spring.
Yeah. It's That's like, right. We would have been like, we're like, yeah. Wow, Jen Samard picked it. We knew it.
Yeah. She knew. All right, now on to the suspects. And there are a few, but for our purposes today, we are going to focus on one. And that's everybody's favorite, Arthur Lee Allen.
Yes.
And James, if this were our spelling bee days, I would make the joke that he had three first names.
Yes. Yes, you would.
Right? Or three last or three last names.
Or three last names, yes.
Arthur Lee Allen.
Lee Allen, yes.
All right, where was I? So Arthur Lee Allen was wonderfully played by John Carroll Lynch in our film. Do you remember him from Fargo?
Oh, yes.
You know that guy? Oh, hey, Marge, I'll make you some eggs. Oh, I love that guy.
So good.
Now, Robert Graysmith is played by Jake Gyllenhaal beautifully. And in Robert Graysmith's book, Zodiac, he suggested that Arthur Lee Allen, and we're going to call him Lee from now on for our ease.
Which is my middle name. Just want you to know.
Oh, it is.
Yes.
But he suggested that he was the Zodiac. This is based on qualitative data, or in other words, circumstantial evidence. Lee was initially interviewed by police on October 6, 1969. He indicated he'd been in the vicinity of the Lake Berryessa attack against Cecilia and Brian on September 27, 1969. In 1971, he came to police's attention again when his friend Donald Cheney told the police that Lee had spoken of his desire to kill people, use the name Zodiac, and secure a flashlight to a firearm for visibility at night. And actually, just going back to that second crime, the 4th of July crime, he did have a flashlight and he just shone it directly into their eyes. Yeah. And what I read was that he would tape the flashlight to the gun that they weren't
separate. They'd be blinded. Yeah, let's see what's happening.
He really thought about it. He put some thought into it.
That's the weird part. That's the crazy part.
Yeah. Other circumstantial evidence includes the brand of typewriter used by the Zodiac. That same brand was found in Lee's home. Lee lived and worked mere steps from Darlene, and that's our young lady who was murdered on the 4th of July. Lee was also born on December 18th, and that's significant because he allegedly spoke with and told Melvin Belli's housekeeper that day that it was his birthday and that he needed to kill someone. Lee also wore a watch. He owned and wore a watch. And James, do you know what the brand of the watch was called?
I believe it was called Zodiac.
Or at least Ding Ding.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, DNA. So... In 2002, because, you know, we have to fast forward all of this time because in the 70s, no such luck, no such chance to use DNA. And in 2002, the San Francisco Police Department got a partial profile from saliva from the stamps and envelopes of Zodiac's letters and compared to Lee. They were not a match. And so while not excluded as a suspect, he was excluded as the contributor of the DNA. Also, a handwriting expert said none of Lee's handwriting samples even came close to those of the Zodiac. And since that time, handwriting analysis validity itself has been brought into question.
That was something I was frustrated with watching the movie. Like, what if it was, you know, what if it was one of these people and you're like, well, the handwriting doesn't match, so he's excluded. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's amazing how far crime technology has come, you know, from 69 to 2000, you know, 20. And the crazy part is watching the film with my wife, who is a scientist. So she starts going into, you know, the DNA didn't match, but you're not thinking about the fact that he could have been smart enough to have someone else, you know, lick the stamps, or the fact that, you know, he always wore gloves. He always wore gloves. There was never a moment where he could put his hands on things to get, you know, he was smart, crazy. I mean, well, I shouldn't say crazy, but mentally something was wrong. But he was smart enough to always wear gloves. But the whole DNA thing was that they were looking for, you know, direct, that's who it is. Also, it was ambidextrous. He could write in different ways. And when you are like that, the handwriting definitely became questionable because he could change it. Mm. He literally could change it. But also, that brings into question that my wife and I were discussing, that brings into question the fact that there could have been more than one.
Yeah.
There could have been a copycat person trying to jump on the trail, which is why the handwriting, you have the guy originally who was smart, he put the things together, and then you have other people who are like, oh, I want to jump in on this, and that's the issue, and that kind of messes up, you know, muddies up the water, because you have actually someone else who's, you know, getting involved.
Or someone helping him. It could be someone help, an accomplice, you know. The inspector's name in real life was Dave Toschi. Brilliantly played by Mark Ruffalo in the film. And in 2010, even though Arthur Lee Allen was Toschi's favorite suspect. He said, yeah, but the DNA evidence exonerated him. Mm. So, you know, it is hard, isn't it? When we, on the one hand, it's in life, we're all like, well, the DNA proved it. So you can't really, it's hard to have it both ways, isn't it?
Well, I mean, but
it is hard.
We also see so many cases of, you know, misidentified murderers or, you know, those who have been, you know, put in jail where they shouldn't be and they were exonerated. Yeah. And that, you know, that's the scary part. So it is really difficult to try and figure out because it could have been this guy. That's the thing.
Yes, that's the thing. It could have been. And either he had help or by the time someone else jumped on, it completely, like I said, muddied the water. So it just tampered with everything. And also there's a moment where I personally, not like I said, not an expert doctor here, but just for now, I personally think it is Lee. I think all the evidence points to Lee. The problem is that if you watch the show 48 hours, if you don't get what's happening in the first 48,
that's right.
So much is lost. And by the time we got to 1974, so much had changed. So much had lost people. Not that people hadn't forgotten, but the DNA begins to degrade. I mean, not DNA, but the evidence begins to degrade. So you can't, it doesn't hold up as strongly. And you could poke holes in things you wouldn't be able to poke holes in before. So by the time you get to 2010, like, oh, well, the DNA doesn't work. You don't know who he's talked to or who sent letters or who did what.
Well, and they didn't, it's funny, they didn't exclude him as a suspect, they just decided he was not the contributor to those samples, but he's still a suspect. In fact, I think he's still the only suspect. Now, as far as the evidence that is not circumstantial, consider this. The survivor of the Lake Berryessa crime, Brian Hartnell, identified Arthur Lee Allen's voice and physical appearance as being similar to Zodiac. And I don't know how hard evidence that is, but this, I think, is even more significant. The survivor of the Blue Rock Springs murder, the 4th of July night, Michael Mageau, picked Lee out of a police lineup as the man who shot him. So, look, here endeth our shallow dive into these very deep waters. But, James, what do you think?
All the evidence really, really does point to him. And there are moments where, even in the interview they had with Lee, he enjoyed teasing he enjoyed teasing the detectives. Mm-hmm. That's a thing, you know. When you want to be noticed, you definitely make yourself noticed, and you know, and you're toying with them, you're playing with them. Hey, you know, figure out it's me, and I'm sitting right in front of you. It's just everything points to him, and also Lee knew. The people, there was two of the people that he killed, he knew the girls. He either lived next to one and then was at a party with another and wanted to talk to her. So there were moments where go ahead.
You brought up a great point. It's the biggest thing from the movie that's a question mark for me. So if you recall, Robert Graysmith goes to prison to talk to a gal named Linda, who is at this painting party that you just referenced. And she saw him. She talked to him. And what I couldn't find anywhere was, even though it was years later, did they show her this driver's license photo of Arthur Lee Allen? Do you know what I mean? Because that would have been something I would imagine would have corroborated
the
stories of the survivors, of Michael Mageau and of Brian Hartnell. And that was never addressed. And
the cops said they spoke to her, but I don't think they showed her a lineup. They just spoke to her.
Right.
But she was, I think, she wasn't a good witness because I guess of her issues.
Interesting.
Oh yeah. Well, and she's a woman, you guys.
There's that. And we're still in, you know, we're talking 1969, 1984. We are still literally in, you know, high collar electronic Neanderthal mode.
Well, or she's hysterical. let's ship her off and get her taken care of. Yeah.
I'm so glad you brought up the party because that was something I wanted to talk about. It was sort of the one gap for me in the film. I was like, wait, but Linda saw his face, you know?
Yes. Yes. Like she saw him and spoke. And he was there, like just kicking it at the party the whole time. And, but.
Wow.
It's amazing.
So to our listeners, If you know the answer, was Linda ever shown his photograph? Let us know. Yeah. And also, I think we've charged you with trying to solve the unsolved cryptogram.
Yes, we have.
The 340 character cryptogram that's never been decoded. You have time. Get on it.
If you solve the crime, Jessica, Jen, and myself will send you a personal selfie of us with shocked faces. And you can totally put those pictures up and say, these are the shocked faces of James, Jen, and Jessica, the three J's, because I solved this. And it would be a great talking point at Christmas.
I was going to say, James, what a great Christmas gift. Three doctors on your tree.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
After you've solved the
Just with
the
shocked faces.
Just shocked docs. Yeah.
Just shocked doc. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, if you solve it, you will get the three selfies of the shocked docs, the three J's on this wonderful podcast. Yes.
Oh, James, I love you so much. Thank you for doing this with us.
Please, this has been great.
I hope you had fun.
Yes. Oh my gosh.
Oh, good.
Give my love to Dawn.
Of course.
James, seriously, thank you so much. This was like one of my favorite ones that we've done because of you.
Thank you. This is great. So. This has been fun. Once Jen told me what it was, I was like, oh, yeah, I want to be involved in this.
Yay. Good. Awesome. Good.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Talk to you soon.
Bye, James.
Bye.
Yay. What a genius.
I love him so much.
He is a true gem, and we are so happy that he was here. We hope that you loved it as well, crime family. And thank you so much for listening. And until next time, keep killing it.
Don't kill anyone.
Crime fam, go to our Patreon page and join us to get exclusive bonus content. And follow us on Instagram at Killing It On Broadway and Twitter at Killing It On B-Way.
Subscribe to us wherever you download your podcasts.
And go ahead and give us a 5-star rating and lovely review. It'll be good for you.
Killing It On Broadway is a production of Killing It On Broadway, LLC.
Music by Mary Mitchell Campbell. Orchestrations, Benedict Braxton Smith.
Edited and engineered by Smokey.
Morale officers, Fred and Nelson. Say goodbye, Fred.
Say goodbye, Nelson.